change, Bank of America would forgive the homeowner's mortgage debt. Then the homeowner would be allowed to lease their home at or below the rental market rate for up to 3 years. In a statement, an executive with the North Carolina Bank says the test run will determine if such a project would be supported by consumers, communities, and investors. For NPR News, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
Government figures show new home sales are down slightly for February, a second straight month of declines. Stronger job growth has helped boost existing home sales, but new home sales haven't benefited, demonstrating instead continuing weakness in the overall housing market. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care, on the web at rwjf.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
WILL news reporters and contributors won 6 awards in the 2011 Associated Press Journalism Excellence Contest, including Best Investigative Series, Best Documentary Series, and Best Sports Story. Reporters Sean Powers, Jeff Bossert, Jim Meadows, Tom Rogers, and Dave Dickey, along with commentator Lisa Braltz and Pam Dempsey of CU Citizen Access, were recognized in the contest's Downstate Radio Division. Congratulations to them and to you for making this coverage possible.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Good morning. Glad to have you with us. This morning, both programs will be coming from the Focus archives, one from January, one from February. You can check the schedule, by the way, by going to our website, and we will be back with live programs for all of next week. So you can go to will.illinois.edu and check out the schedule and, of course, listen to past programs. But for this morning, we won't be taking calls. This first show was first broadcast on February 2nd. Most conflicts, and this applies to global conflicts and interpersonal ones, most of them end up being resolved peacefully. Sometimes all that's necessary is some mediation and, of course, a willingness of the people involved to talk with one another. Yet scholars tell us, if you look back over the past couple of hundred years of history, one out of every 20 conflicts, and we're talking about 5%, ends in a stalemate with the two sides locked hard into their positions. These are disputes that rarely go away. Often they get worse, and they can escalate to the point of violence. Our guest for this hour of the show, Peter Coleman, says that the only solution to these 5% is to try and see the conflicts in a new way. This morning, in this hour, we will talk with Peter Coleman. He's director of the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution. He is also associate professor of psychology and education at Columbia University and has been working and doing research in this area, that is the area of seemingly impossible conflicts. He's been doing that for now more than a decade. And he's authored a book that explores this territory. And if you're interested in reading more, you can look at his book. The title of his book is The 5%, Finding Solutions to Seemingly Impossible Conflicts. Public Affairs is the publisher. You can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore or library or wherever you go for books. And Professor Coleman, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I am fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Good. Very much. Glad to be on air.
Well, I'm pleased that you could talk with us. I think it's a really fascinating area. And I think I'm sure when people think about intractable conflict on the international scale, there are certain things that will come to mind readily, and you can engage them in conversation around things like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but also other places, Northern Ireland, Kashmir, places in Latin America, elsewhere. So there are plenty of examples. I was, though, kind of interested that I came across a little essay that you had written and was published in a legal publication, something called The Law Insider, where you talked about your long interest in this. And the fact that it really started because you were working as a counselor working with violent urban youth in psychiatric hospitals, and also as a community mediator for the New York State criminal courts. So I think that suggests that what we're talking about here does indeed, it's not just a macro kind of thing, that it can apply to conflicts that are a little smaller in scale.
Yeah, we found that these types of conflicts happen to some degree readily in families, for example. It can happen between around a divorce and around settlement issues for a divorce, and which can sometimes be protracted and go on and on. It can happen between siblings or members of family that don't want to leave their family but get locked into some kind of antagonistic struggle with a member of their family. So we see it at all levels. Yes, I did. I did experience it to some degree working with violent offenders, seeing that, working with them and treating them provided some sense of perspective for them and some degree of change. But basically, there was so much attrition, they would come back again and again and again, that it seemed like it was a problem bigger than the individual, and that we really needed to think differently about how we treat these kinds of ongoing conflicts. And I think, in fact, addiction is a worthwhile metaphor. It's not completely accurate, but it does give us a sense of how these dynamics, these conflict dynamics of these particularly difficult conflicts, fall into a pattern that is very resistant to change.
Yeah. To talk a little bit about the idea of the 5%, this comes out of work of scholars who have, as I said at the outset, have looked back over a couple of hundred years of conflict around the world and looked to see what got resolved and what didn't. And they found that about 5% were very stubborn. They ended up in grinding stalemates that can just go on for decades in spite of attempts at mediation.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a research by Paul Diehl and Gary Goetz, and they study a thing called the Correlates of War database, which is, again, as you say, a 200-year-long database starting from about 1816. And it looks at really all international exchanges, trade exchanges or violent exchanges between countries. And it's able to kind of look at, from the long-term perspective, which ones of those have been settled peacefully and which move into relationships that are constructive and cooperative, and that a smaller percentage get into what they call enduring rivalries, kind of long-term antagonistic, competitive, and usually military exchanges. And their approach is not to look at wars as isolated incidents, but to look at these kind of long-term relationships between countries and see that, if you look over 200 years, you see, there are these cycles of war that they go in and out of, and that's part of the context of the relationship. And that is this small percentage of about 5% of the difficult conflicts that they study that are particularly difficult, and they last. Their criteria is something like over 25 years. On average, they last about 36 years, but some, as you alluded to in your introduction, can go on much longer. For example, the Israel-Palestine conflict, depending on how you count it, some would say is more than 100 years old. It started with the ending of the Ottoman Empire, and others would, place it at more 50 or 60 years. But on average, these conflicts seem to grind on in the international domain, something like 40 years plus.
Yeah. And I'm sure that that's, while some people might say, if 95% of the conflicts get settled, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
The problem with the 5% is that these are the ones that start wars.
Yeah, about half of the wars that have taken place since 1816 are international wars, are come out of these kinds of enduring conflicts, and about 76% of the intrastate, interethnic, or geopolitical conflicts that happen within countries come out of this type of relationship. So they're extremely expensive. They cause great human suffering and instability of families and communities and even regions. So they really require a fair amount of attention. But I do want to say that, the good news is that, yes, about, 95% or so of most of the conflicts, even the more difficult conflicts we face, are resolved constructively. And, in fact, that number has been going up really since the end of the Cold War. We see more and more settlements through negotiation and peace processes than we've ever seen before. In fact, the number of negotiated peace processes versus the number of conflicts that were resolved through violence have flipped since the Cold War. So, that's the good news. The bad news is that when these about 25% of these conflicts that are resolved through negotiations fail. And when they fail, the chances of them becoming protracted and grinding on and on escalates immeasurably. So So the good news is we're resolving more conflicts peacefully. The bad news is when those peace processes fail, they become much more difficult to resolve. Yeah.
Our guest, just very quickly to introduce for anybody who might have tuned in last few minutes, our guest is Peter Coleman. He is Associate Professor of Psychology and Education at Columbia University. He's Director of the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution. He's also on the faculty of Teachers College and the Earth Institute at Columbia. And we are talking about what you will find in his recent book, The 5%, Finding Solutions to Seemingly Impossible Conflicts. Well, given the fact that these 5% are potentially very dangerous, that they can lead to a lot of bloodshed and they can spread, it's important to, you know, you've argued, well, given that, it's pretty important to try to understand these conflicts and what is it about them that makes them so difficult. And I know that you got, once you start getting into this, you started to say, well, okay, so what's the essence? What is the essence of the 5%? And the thing is that once you start listing things, the list starts to grow and grow and grow. In fact, it's here in the book, and you find here that there are, in fact, 57 different things that you say these are the essences of intractable conflict.
Yeah, so when I first started to do research in this area, we didn't know much about these kinds of problems. And so I looked to what scholars had identified as what they saw as key, as central to the problems, that why they grind on and on. And the further I looked, the more of these essences I found. And so, you know, ironically, in trying to understand it in real simple terms, in essential terms, I found how complex these problems tend to become over time. And as you can imagine, even in an interpersonal conflict in a family that drags on for 10 years, 20 years, more people get involved, more issues get involved, more incidents are fed into it. So it does become more complicated over time. The literature is very complicated, but what we found to be that these conflicts have in common, and again, this is whether they're in families or in nations or between nations, is that what tends to occur is they become more complex and complicated with more elements and people involved over time, but yet they're seen and experienced as very simple. So, for example, a conflict like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, long history, many players, many issues, different leaders coming and going, different policies, all of which have affected the dynamics of the conflict. But oftentimes it's really seen in very simple us-them terms. You know, it's the Palestinians' resistance to recognizing Israel and resistance to a peace process or resistance to giving up violence, or it's the Israelis' stubbornness, the Israelis' insistence on, you know, creating new settlements. You know, it's oftentimes seen in kind of simple us-them terms. So that's one of the things that happens, is that all of these complicated factors start to collapse and kind of feed each other in a dynamic way, and then they're seen in very simple terms. And it's that kind of oversimplification of the problems that becomes part of the problem, part of the ongoing dynamic. Because if you see it, if you see a very complicated thing in very overly simplistic terms, you get trapped and you really can't find a way out.
And that, I think, that shows you why it is that's so difficult here, because the difficult thing here is that you're fighting against a very human tendency, yeah, when confronted with enormous complexity as a way of trying to get a hold on it, and is to strip it down to its simplest elements.
Yeah, it is a very common, you know, if you think about just every day when you're walking down the street, if you're in a city or even in the country, you get inundated with a lot of different stimuli and people and images. And what we do psychologically, what we need to do is to simplify our understanding of the world to make it predictable, right? So we will take a complex cityscape as we walk down the street in Manhattan and, you know, really understand it in simple terms. Understand it that, you know, you don't attend to everything, you just attend to certain things, right? And that provides a sense of stability and predictability to our life, which I think is very important. particularly in conflict, when you're engaged in a conflict, understanding what's important in the conflict, understanding who's with you and who's against you, those things become really, really important. And so it is a natural response. But again, what happens in these more and more complicated and threatening situations is that natural process becomes, to some degree, somewhat pathological. We get stuck in oversimplifying our understanding of the other group, of our own lack of responsibility of the situation. We really centralize it and oversimplify it, and we get trapped in that kind of thinking. And then we have a difficult time, again, finding a way out. Mm.
And I think also one of the things you should point out, though, is that sometimes I think when confronted with overwhelming complexity, that rather than engaging in and getting a handle on it by engaging in this oversimplifying, sometimes also what people do is that they sort of throw up their hands and they say, well, it is so complex, there is really no way to understand it. And I think this often happens, you know, as an outsider looking at one of these very complex conflicts, you say, well, it's so complex, it's been going on for so long, it's impossible for me to understand, and therefore there's really anything that can be done about this, so we'll just kind of throw up our hands and say, well, you know, those people, they've been fighting for all this time, and they're always going to fight, and there's nothing we can do about it, and I have something better to do with my time. But people then just give up.
Yeah, and absolutely. So, for outsiders, it seems overwhelmingly complicated. It's always changing, and one response is just that it's hopeless. You really can't do anything about it, and that happens for insiders as well. For disputants involved in these things, they do tend to feel overwhelmed. They do tend to feel hopeless, and part of what contributes to that is you'll have a good faith attempt at somebody coming in and trying to mediate, or a new peace process that's introduced. And then it'll fail, or it'll be seen as a failure. And then that leads to what we call peace fatigue. Eventually people feel like, look, nothing that anyone has done has made any real difference. This is an impossible situation. And, of course, that kind of mindset will contribute to the belief that it will be impossible, and the fact that it will continue to be impossible, because people really lose the energy and the motivation to try to seek new solutions. So that is, you know, what we call a kind of reinforcing feedback loop. You know, the more hopeless you feel, the more discouraged and the more sense of fatigue that you have, the less you will engage actively in peace processes, and the lower the probabilities that you'll be able to find a way out.
Yeah. So it seems that one of the big challenges that you face in coming to a conflict like this and is having the people who are engaged or have some sort of a stake find a balance point between oversimplification on the one side and giving up because they're overwhelmed by the complexity on the other.
You're exactly right, and that's it's sort of what we call the sweet spot, or the optimal spot, between not being completely overwhelmed by the chaos and complexity of a situation, but not oversimplifying it into sort of us and them terms, and being able to navigate that area in between, where you respect and understand the complexity, and respect that things are always changing, but also have a sense that, you know, some things matter more than others, and that there are things that we can do to make a difference. And that oftentimes requires that middle spot. And what's interesting about that, of what you describe, is that that's a phenomenon that's found really at all levels of science, even from sort of levels of physical science and neurology to psychological health. So there's a book by a man named Daniel Siegel, who's a psychologist, and he studied the DSM-5, which is the new diagnostic manual in psychology. And part of what he finds is that most of the pathologies in mental health are either people sort of collapsing and becoming very obsessed and overly focused on something, or becoming very disorganized and chaotic, or moving from one to the other in rapid succession. So by definition, a healthy mental perspective is in between. It's been in between overwhelmingly complex and overwhelmingly ordered, that we psychologically need to navigate a space where there's order and predictability, but also openness to change and flexibility. And that's the same kind of orientation that we say is critical and necessary for understanding these kinds of problems effectively and engaging with them constructively.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the difficulty that comes with the tendency of people to oversimplify complex situations that confront them. And you and I know you and your colleagues who have looked at the 5% problems have tried to apply science, different kinds of science to them. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there is, even in science, a principle that says, well, if you're trying to explain something and you have two different ways of explaining it, chances are the simpler of the two is the correct explanation.
Yeah.
How do you get around, even within science, the tendency to perhaps try to render extremely complex things too simple?
Sure. Well, again, that is sort of the good news and bad news about the science. There is, as you say, a value in science for parsimony. We like the simplest answer possible. And to some degree, that's helped us understand what I would always say is sort of pieces of the problem of conflict. We understand, you know, certain aspects of why conflicts get better and get worse. It's because of how people think or how they respond or what their behavioral strategies are. You know, we know a lot of the pieces of the problem. And so trying to essentialize and focus in on those, you know, smaller pieces of the puzzle have taught us some things, but ultimately it doesn't help us understand these more complex dynamic systems of conflict and how they function and how those little pieces interact with each other and come together. So what's required in science, you know, we say is sort of a balance between both, that you need an approach that understands what the important pieces are, but you also need to understand how those pieces will come together and affect each other to affect patterns of social relations, whether they're more constructive and healthy patterns in a family or community, or whether they're more destructive patterns. And what are the critical pieces that will determine those differences in patterns? So it's what we say sort of a both and. You know, systems theory came around about 30 years ago trying to say, you know, oversimplification in science is a problem. We need to put everything in a complex context. And that got us so far, but a lot of the systems models were so complex we couldn't make much sense of them. And so what we believe is that, again, it's sort of that space in between, respecting the complexity and the dynamics of the problem, but understanding that even within that, some things are more important than others and will affect the patterns that we see evolve over time.
We have a caller and would welcome others. Number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we have a toll-free line that's good to wherever you can hear us. So if you would be making a long-distance call, we'll pay for it, 800-222-9455. We do have email also, by the way, if you'd like to join us that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a caller here in Effingham. We'll go there on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My observation of your guest's subject matter entails devious behavior and self-interest, and who profits and who does not. And a little further on the his example of Israel and the evolution of that from the time they first invaded that part of the world and ousted the inhabitants there, just as that's been going on around the world since we learned how to sail, and before then even. But in the year 70 A.D., Titus, the Emperor Titus, the Roman, tried to exterminate the Israelis, and he nearly got it done, but they were tenacious, hung on, and then in 1948, the United States, with the help of United States and the UN reestablished them there in 1948. Since then, there has been absolutely no progress except the erosion of the Palestinians and the supposed extermination of them by the Israelis and taking over all of Palestine. I'll ring off with that because it's very complex, and all the subject matter, I think, is pertinent to that one place on this earth. Thank you.
Well, all right. I really don't want to turn the conversation here this morning into a program on the Arab-Israeli conflict, but that seems to be the one of the ones mm-hmm. that people are going to go right to if for their case studies. So I don't know what how you might respond to the caller, but
I can respond generally just by saying there is a long history in around the world, and there's a long history in that region. One of the things that's tricky is that the depiction of history is contested. So there are different versions and views on history, depending on which parties or stakeholders you talk to, depending on how far back you go. And that is, of course, oftentimes one of the key issues in this conflict is who has legitimate rights to this land and how far back do those rights go. But what's interesting to me and what's important is, as the caller alluded to, is the same phenomenon has happened elsewhere in the world. If you look at America, at some point, you know, Europeans came to this country and basically took over the country, and there was, you know, atrocities committed at that time, and so it has its own history of intergroup struggle as part of the context of this country, and yet this country isn't locked currently in an ongoing war of the nature that Israel-Palestine is. So what's the difference? And you know, there are many stories around the world of occupation and oppression that have gone on, but don't result in this kind of dynamic. So our question is always, well, why is this different? And part of why it's different is, yes, the history, yes, the agenda of some of the parties and players through the ages have had their own investments and interests, but that's only one piece of what occurs, and those players come and go, and yet the conflict and the dynamics of the conflict remain the same. So how do we understand that? And that's how we try to look at this, is not in terms of any one source of a problem, but in terms of how a variety of different elements of the problem come together and collapse and create this pattern, and how does thinking about it that way give us different levers for change. Hmm.
The guest in this hour of Focus is Peter Coleman. He is Associate Professor of Psychology and Education at Columbia University. He is also Director of the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution. He's on the faculty of Teachers College and the Earth Institute at Columbia, and is the author of the book, The 5%, Finding Solutions to Seemingly Impossible Conflicts. Public Affairs is the publisher of the book. Questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you want to send us an email, you can do that. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we'll talk with someone in Belgium, the next community not too far away. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. And from your discussion, it seems as though to resolve a problem, you try to take the most reasonable yet simplest way through the situation. And it seems as though war is probably the most simple way to deal with it.
Okay. Professor Coleman, you have some response to that?
Well, so war is... of course, never simple. War is a choice. War is an extremely expensive choice, not only in terms of treasure, but also in terms of human suffering and life and the long-term consequences of that. So, I mean, again, war is a strategy. It's a strategy that the human species has resorted to all too frequently in our history, less and less so, which I think is an important thing to recognize. And I wouldn't see it as a simple choice. I see it as oftentimes, again, it depends on whether you're talking metaphorically about between two people or whether you're talking about nations or within a nation. But war is, of course, if you look at what's happened in Afghanistan and Iraq over the past 10 years, it's an extremely demanding and complex and expensive choice. I think is by most policymakers recognized as such.
But, sir, what I'm meaning is, It's a complex endeavor to take on. I understand that, to go to war. But the decision to go to war is much easier than the decision to try to make peace with all these groups that have problems.
Well, again, I would have to disagree with that. I think that the decision makers, most of the decision makers that are involved in these kinds of decisions, recognize the extraordinary trade-offs and costs and consequences of that choice. I think that diplomacy is a difficult thing, but most conflicts are resolved through negotiation, mediation, other forms of diplomacy and problem solving. So the vast majority are, and it's much rarer to have countries or governments make the conscious decision to go to war. Again, that has become less and less frequent through the ages. And I have to say, I believe the policymakers, most policymakers, would recognize the extreme demands of such a choice.
Thank you very much. Right.
Well, if you, you know, we talked earlier about the fact that these intractable conflicts are very complicated. And if you start asking the question, well, what are the features of these conflicts, the characteristics that make them so complicated and difficult to solve, that pretty soon you get a very long list. And not only, and these, and you have to look at the features on your, the points on your list. They cannot be looked at in isolation because they're related to one another, and they affect one another, and they feed back on one another. So if what you start to do, and you've done it in the book here, people can see it, then if you start to lay out things and try to establish the ways that they're connected and draw lines between some of these various points, pretty soon you end up with something that looks like the plate of spaghetti. So then the question is, you look at that and you think, well, where does one wade in here? At what point do you pick to start? And particularly because one of the things you also acknowledge is that you can do something that you think will have a positive effect and do it with the best of intentions, and you never quite know what's likely to happen. Certainly things that happen that you do not intend, and sometimes those things are not helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, what we try to lay out in the book is both a sort of a way of thinking and a way of analyzing and then eventually responding to these conflicts that will, you know, affect the probabilities of success, or increase the probabilities that, you know, more constructive things will happen, and decrease the probabilities that more destructive things will happen. And there is no guarantee, but part of what we found, for example, in just how people think about these problems is there's an idea called integrative complexity, and it's what they've found in research of people that have this characteristic or are high on what they call integrative complexity, which I'll explain in a second, is that they're better leaders, they tend to be more conciliatory in conflict, find more creative solutions, their followers are more satisfied and get their needs met, and so they tend to be more effective decision makers. And what integrative complexity means is that people are able to look at a problem, and they face a new problem, and they're able to see different components of it and different aspects of it and how those different things are related. So similar to what you described of kind of drawing out a map and making links between them, so you can start to see the big picture and how a variety of different aspects are feeding each other, but then are able to focus in on what's most important and make a decision and act. So integrative complexity is this process of basically breaking something apart, seeing the connections, and then focusing in on something with a decision or an action. But then once you've done that, you kind of back up again and say, all right, so now what's happening in the big picture, and what does that mean for my next decision? So it's this kind of iterative, ongoing process of making things more complicated and then focusing in on what seems to be an actionable item and then backing up again, right? And so that process of understanding and engaging problems that way, research has shown us, is much more effective in creating well-being, in engaging difficult problems, and in resolving conflict, certainly in the international realm, but also within business and the industry. They've found similar kind of correlations. So that's basically what we try to describe in the book, not only that way of seeing problems and engaging problems, but what are the specific techniques you can use if you have to sit down and figure out a problem or figure out a conflict and how to respond. How can you, as you say, both see the big picture, but then also get focused and know what to act on?
All right, let's go to let's take another caller here, Urbana, line one.
Yes, I usually agree with the previous caller on much of what he has to say, but it seems to me this time, if I understand him properly, that the easiness of war—it's very easy to get into wars. Awfully difficult to resolve the problems that they create. The First World War certainly led directly to the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the wisdom of George Marshall and Kennan, and I suppose Acheson, and I can't think of the Republican senator now that deserves equal credit with them, that they resolved the war without resorting to vengeance. And for perhaps the first time in human history, sought a settlement that would not lead to further wars. And they were rather successful. The two Bush wars, I think, are excellent cases in point. Terribly easy to get into them. But I doubt if we see the end of their effect on history for a long time. These people still remember the Mongol invasion. And talk to any Iraqi, and they'll tell you what they think of the Persians and the Turks marching across their country 1,000 years ago. These things last a long time. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think the caller makes some good points. You know, as we remember, World War I was the war to end all wars, and the main players in World War I that engaged the conflict really believed that it would be short-lived. They thought that they could get in and out pretty quickly. They thought that because trade relations between the countries were so strong, that people wouldn't really have an appetite for war very long. And years later, they found millions dead and unbelievable costs. And they found that they had gotten trapped into this. And as the caller says, it established the conditions for World War II. So I do think there is some degree of learning going on, that the scale of war is smaller currently than it has been in the past or around world wars. But it's also true that our decision makers here and around the world sometimes have bad information. I mean, both certainly the Iraqi war was based on erroneous intelligence or a refusal to attend to all of the intelligence and not process that in a way that informed the decision, you know, in any sophisticated way. So there are problems made by our policymakers, but I do think to some degree the culture of Earth and the culture of war, we seem to be learning some lessons, not always, and it's not a perfect trend, but it is, I think, generally speaking, a positive trend.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Peter Coleman. He is Associate Professor of Psychology and Education at Columbia University, Director of the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution, someone who for something like 15 years now has been studying seemingly impossible conflicts, trying to get at the question, well, what really might it take to solve some of these seemingly impossible conflicts? And he writes about this in his book, The 5%, Finding Solutions to Seemingly Impossible Conflicts. Public Affairs is the publisher. One of the things that you and some of your colleagues have done is that you have recruited people for studies, and you bring them into the laboratory, and you take a couple of people, you take two people, and you try to find two people that are on opposite sides of one very contentious issue. And then you sit them down, and what you say to them is just, well, we would like you to just talk about this, talk about what your positions are, how you feel, what you think of the other person, and so forth. And that what you get is you get some people who very quickly come to deadlock, where they find that their positions are so solid that there's nothing that it seems that they can agree on. And then you have some people that, in the process of this conversation, find, well, in fact, while they do have these two very different opposing ideas of something, that there is a middle ground that they can find to inhabit, and there are some things that they can find to agree on. So what is the difference? What makes the difference between the people that find they have some middle ground and the people that get to the point very quickly where they have really nothing to talk about?
Yeah, so just to back up for a second, we do a lot of different kinds of research. We do case studies of long-term conflicts that move into peace, and we do modeling. Our team is an eclectic team of anthropologists and political scientists and mathematicians and physicists who have different ways of working. The way that I've primarily worked is more in the lab, and so we have set up what we call a moral conflict lab or a difficult conflict lab. We have one at Columbia, and then my colleague Katerina Kugler has another in Munich at the Ludwig Maximilian University there. And what we've found in our research is that there are radically different patterns that happen. So, yes, we measure people in terms of an attitude on morally divisive issues, such as, you know, abortion or pro-life, pro-choice. And we'll bring them in. So we find that two people who have, you know, basically polarized views of that, bring them into the lab and ask them to have a conversation about it and to try to reach some kind of consensus, to write some kind of a statement that they both can agree on. And then part of what we look at is the dynamics that unfold as they have the conversation, their emotional dynamics over time, how they think about the problem over time, how they treat each other and behave over time. And we look at very different patterns of that. And what we find goes back to the point that you made earlier on about the difference between kind of overwhelming complexity and overwhelming simplicity. What we find in the conversations that get stuck is that their emotions get jammed into this sort of negative space. Their thinking becomes very simple and very us and them, and their behavior becomes really them sort of demanding that their position be recognized. The other group that end up in more constructive conversations show what we call much higher complexity in their emotional experience, behavior, and thinking. So what does that mean? It means that even though I'm having a conversation and I'm, say, pro-life and the other party is pro-choice, and I'm having a conversation about something that's important to me and that's difficult to talk about, and I'm speaking to someone who has a very different opinion than I am, it's not that I feel great, but I'm able to not get sort of sucked into and stuck in this negative experience of the other and to feel different things as the conversation evolves. And I'm able to think about the problem and the issues related to, say, pro-life, pro-choice in more nuanced ways with more subtlety and behave in a way that's consistent with that. So we see these different patterns. And what we did in Munich is we actually did an experiment where we would actually manipulate people's levels of complexity as they went into these conversations. That means that we took information about the issue of abortion, and we either presented it to people as pro and con, so we gave them the information of both sides but presented it as, you know, this side is pro, you know, say pro-life, and this side is more supportive of choice. Or we present the same information in a more subtle way, saying, well, this is a complex issue, and there are a variety of different issues here. There are legal issues, there are issues of health, issues for the child, the mother, the fetus. So we lay out the same information, but with a very different structure. And what we find there is that when that information is presented in a more complex and nuanced way, people are able to engage it. It's not that they come to a solution around the abortion debate, but they are able to engage in a conversation where they feel they can learn, they understand a bit of the other's point of view, and they actually are able to find a statement that they can both agree to. Again, not a solution to the problem, but here are the aspects that we agree to. You know, we agree that this is an important issue for women and that women need to be supported on this, and that they're, you know, that it's a difficult issue. So they're able to eventually find some common ground that they can write about and feel good about.
Mm-hmm. And now, I guess some people would say that, though, doing that in a laboratory setting and doing that in the real world are two different things, because you end up having because the problem with these intractable conflicts is, in fact, so often you have groups of people who do indeed end up, get to a point where they see the world in terms of us and them, and they say, and the issue here is that they are nothing like us. We are nothing like them. Our worldview is completely different. Our experiences are completely different. We don't even use the same kind of language to talk about things. That there's just no way for there to be any kind of conversation.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And oftentimes that happens under conditions where they and you have no contact with each other. Mm-hmm. So you really start to assume a lot and you start to put a lot onto the other group and a lot onto your own group that is perhaps not accurate. What we find is there are actually, you know, some very interesting groups in this country and around the world that do use processes similar to what I just described. So there's, for example, in the United States, there's a group called the National Issues Forum, and you can go to their website and see what they do. And what they do is they sort of watch the news for very polarizing issues that come out. And when a particular issue is on the national agenda and it seems like there is a kind of oversimplified discourse on that issue, they'll research it. They'll create a presentation on the information that's much more nuanced, that says, okay, here are the multiple levels of this issue that we need to understand. And then they'll bring them into the community, and they'll hold community groups and forums that are facilitated by professionals, where they say, all right, here's the information. Let's have a conversation about it based on this information. So it's a structure of educating and engaging people in conversations that moves them beyond oversimplified vitriol and hate of the other group, and engages them in a conversation around the problems and the issues that are more nuanced, and which allow people then to be honest and open and hear each other in a way that when you get into these kind of what we call autistic hostilities, people can't. So there are real-world illustrations and examples and opportunities for people to engage in this kind of understanding of difficult, polarizing issues.
Yeah. Something that I think is interesting that I picked up from listening to you is that in one of the ways that you actually can intervene, or it's possible to intervene in these seemingly intractable conflicts, is when you look at them and you look at these groups of people, and it may appear on the surface that we have two distinct groups of people who just aren't talking and have nothing in common. Well, the fact is that if you actually start looking, you find that there are places, they may be isolated, but that there are little places here and there where people actually are talking and they're doing something together and they have a common interest and they've found a way to maybe put the other stuff aside at least a little bit and come together around, you know, whatever it is they're coming together. And that may be identifying those kinds of places can give you some kind of leverage. That's something that you can use, and that can be a place for getting for intervention.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a very important insight, because I have a colleague, Laura Chasen, who works with communities that are polarized over issues, and she says that the first thing she does when she goes into one of these communities or is invited in to work with them is she tries to identify what she calls networks of effective action. She said even though you may be dealing with in a war zone, or you're dealing with a community that's very polarized over a particular moral issue, that usually there are often people and groups who are still in conversation with each other across the divide. They're still trying to stay connected to their colleagues or to people on the other side and who have different points of view, and are willing to and effectively engage that. And so she tries to identify them first, and as opposed to coming in like the cavalry and imposing a solution or a set of ideas, she says, you know, these people, they know how to talk to each other. They know how to make sense. They know how to tolerate this. So let's see if there are careful ways we can support that. There's a book by Gabriella Bloom, who is a Harvard Law professor, called Islands of Agreement. And she finds the same thing in these long-term international conflicts, such as in Kashmir. What she finds is that even in those settings where you have ongoing violence between the parties, if you look carefully, you still find that there are trade agreements, there are businesses that are working across the boundaries, there are citizen exchanges, educational or cultural exchanges taking place between the communities. And typically that doesn't make the news, and it's not part of the story we hear of Kashmir, but they are happening. And if you can identify those sort of quietly and support those in ways that don't bring them negative attention, then you can sort of grow you can help support the community's own ability to kind of repair its own issues and its own problems. And it's a much more organic way to address the problems than to come in from the outside with solutions that are not well informed.
Yeah. We have, I'm sorry to say, maybe about a minute or so. For those people who are listening to us and who are, their brief is not solving the Arab-Israeli conflict. They're just trying to work things out with people who are very close to them. Is there something that you can use in all of this to apply to dealing with interpersonal conflict?
Well, there is, and again, the book goes into this in more detail. But there are sort of basic practices that people can employ if they find themselves in a situation where they see themselves easily fall back into conflict with someone in their life, and they're tired of it. They want out, but they can't seem to break that pattern. Then there are some sort of simple practices that we recommend that people employ, which can start to move it out. I mean, part of it to recognize is that there aren't quick fixes to long-term conflicts and problems. There aren't quick solutions, but there are possibilities that can be employed. There are more subtle strategies that can be employed that over time can really have a big impact. And I've had this experience myself. I've had a long-term conflict with a cousin of my wife, and we were very estranged from each other for a long period of time. But in writing this book, I thought, all right, I have to take this seriously and really attempt to begin to open myself up to other possibilities and attempt to engage this in a different way. And I found that it's actually been very helpful even for me.
All right. The book that we've talked about is The 5%, Finding Solutions to Seemingly Impossible Conflicts, published by Public Affairs by our guest Peter Coleman. He is Associate Professor of Psychology and Education at Columbia University and is Director of the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution. Professor Coleman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much.
And you have been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This was a show that we first broadcast on February 2nd. This show and many others available on our web archive. You can listen anytime that you're ready. You can get the schedule there as well. The address is will.illinois.edu. In the second part of the program, this is also an archive from the end of January, and this was a conversation with Dr. David Ansell. He's a physician. Currently, he works as the chief medical officer at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. Back in 1978, fresh out of medical school, he went to Cook County Hospital to do his internship. Cook County is one of the oldest public hospitals in the United States. It's a place where there's been a lot of major medical achievements, but it's also been a place that has been long troubled by underfunding, by poor management, and also by political interference. He says, though, that at the time he decided to go there, Cook County Hospital was ground zero for all of the crucial questions facing the U.S. healthcare system, and those are questions that we still face today. He's authored a memoir about his experiences there at Cook County Hospital. We talked about it back in January, and that is the show that you will hear in the next part of Focus. Again, you can check out our schedule by going to the website. That's will.illinois.edu.
Illinois public media stations celebrate 90 years of public service broadcasting. To kick off a year of memories and celebrations, NPR congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook will visit the WILL studios. Join Andrea Seabrook and the WILL news team for a wine and cheese reception on Wednesday, April 11. Tickets are $25 a person. Reservations can be made by calling 217-333-7300.
I want to also mention a special set of programs that we'll be doing next week on the program, here on radio and also on television. And they all have to do with housing, and particularly the fact that there is a great need for affordable rental housing all over America, but certainly in our communities. We'll be talking on the program Monday morning at 10 o'clock about housing issues in Champaign and Vermilion counties. Our guest will be Kevin Jackson. He's the director for the City of Champaign Neighborhood Services, and also Libby Tyler. Works with the city Urbana. She's the Community Development Services Director there. And we'll give you an overview of housing issues in our communities. And then I do want to mention that Tuesday night on WILL-TV, also on AM and online, we'll have a special program where we'll bring some folks in who deal with housing issues in our area, and we'll talk about some of these issues. And it'll be on television live. It'll also be on AM, and we'll stream that program also on our website, will.illinois.edu. It's a special thing, and we'll be doing a number of programs related to housing in the weeks ahead, so we hope that you can tune in for some of those programs. Well, now we'll take a break, as we usually do, to bring you an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
WILL agricultural programs and services are made possible by the Friends of WILL and by Risk Management Commodities, Farm Credit Services, and Steel Star Metal Roofing and Siding. Thank you for your continued support.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity market. We're at mid-session.
July, 645 and three quarters, up 3. September, 582 and a half, unchanged. December, 558, up 2 and a quarter. And the March at 568 and a quarter, up 2 and a quarter. May soybeans, 1365 and a quarter, up 15 and three quarters.